Welcome to Inside Seaweed. This is the podcast where we talk about the incredible world of seaweed and how this growing industry is bringing innovation and solutions to address climate change and the environmental crisis. My guest today is Dr. Thierry Chopin. He was born and educated in France, where he gained a PhD from the University of Western Brittany. He then moved to Canada, where he is professor of marine biology at the University of New Brunswick in St. John. He is also the founder and president of two companies, Chopin Coastal Health Solution Inc. and Turquoise Revolution Inc. He is a true global expert on seaweed cultivation, to the point of being knighted by his native country in 2021 for his extensive research and passion for seaweed. He has published more than 250 papers, spacing from cultivation of seaweed of commercial value, integrated multi-trophic aquaculture, which you'll hear referred to as IMTA, economic diversification, and societal acceptability. Dr. Chopin promotes a greener blue economy, which he branded the turquoise economy, in which ecosystem services are recognized, valued, and used within a circular economy approach. We had a wide-ranging conversation. I certainly learned a lot, had a great time, laughed a few times even, so hopefully we'll make you laugh a few times as well. Here it goes. Dr. Thierry Chopin, such an honor to talk to you today. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Thank you very much. And I'm glad to talk to you too.
Thanks for making the time today and welcome to Inside Seaweed. I'd like to start, if I may, with the ice bucket challenge. You remember that?
Yes.
You sound worried. I'm going to show you a very, very short clip.
Yeah, Sakarida. So
that's
the three clips we have here.
Can you see the screen?
Let's yes, go for yes.
The ice bucket challenge.
All right.
Okay. Go, Adrian. Okay. Ooh, that's good. Oh, nice kelp. And you know these kelp, they are...
For those listening to this, I should point out that there was seaweed in that bucket with what looks like some very, very... cold water.
Oh yeah, no, they were ice cube. It was not only seaweed, but they were ice cube too.
So that was back in 2014, I believe.
Yeah, I don't remember the year because with COVID we lose track of everything. But yeah, it was at the.
But where are we?
That was the Bellefondy, just not very far from where the university is. And it was the year where there was this ALS water bucket challenge. And you were having somebody throwing you a bucket full of ice cubes. And we added seaweed. And we made a donation for ALS.
So is Bellefondy where you're based at the moment?
Yeah, no, I am based in St. John, New Brunswick, which is on the Bellefondy. On the water, never gets that warm, but when you add a few ice cubes, that's even colder.
Yeah, and I bet nobody did it with seaweed before.
No.
That must have been a first. Interesting to know the story behind it,
yeah,
for sure. Moving on to the recent paper that you published, Farming the Ocean, Seaweed as a Quick Fix for the climate, question mark. Yeah. We often hear people looking for a silver bullet to fix climate change or the environmental crisis, when in reality what we need is a portfolio of solutions.
Yes. Yeah.
Should we shift our approach, do you think, from trying to find the solution to a mentality where we look at implementing many different solutions, whether it's electric cars, solar panels, nuclear, etc.? And the follow-up question is, can seaweed be one of these solutions? What role can seaweed play?
Yeah, no, seaweeds, you know, I have been working on seaweeds for 42 years, and that's why my beard is white now. Over 42 years, yes, seaweeds are great organisms, a lot of properties, very diverse properties and very diverse uses. But at the same time, we should not depend depict or describe seaweeds as a silver bullet that will solve all the problem of the world. You know, when I hear or when I read seaweeds, underwater superhero that will solve all the climate change issues and everything, then I have problem with that. But yes, seaweeds can be part of the solution, not 100%, but they could be maybe 10% solution for that, 5% solution for something else. So it's a combination, and then other things than seaweeds, mangroves, salt marshes, solar, wind farms and all things. And also seaweed, you have to see them not only as growing them, but also seaweed as substitution. Can we use seaweed for other products that require more carbon to be grown or to be processed? And can we substitute by seaweeds and on that save in carbon emission? So that's the kind of things. But yes, no, seaweeds are great. Don't take me wrong. Seaweeds are great, but they are part of the solution. They are not 100% silver bullet. And they can be used in many things that all together will help.
So they're not the solution, but they definitely we shouldn't dismiss them as not one of them.
No, that's correct. Yes. And in terms, for example, of carbon sequestration, we have to be careful because, like, for example, if you grow seaweeds and then transfer them to land, and on land you transform them in something else that will be used for food or other application, your carbon doesn't disappear. Your carbon is transformed and is part of other compounds that you will use or that you will eat, but the carbon doesn't disappear magically. So that's what I like to talk about, transient sequestration.
So what really happens to the carbon once you've harvested the seaweed?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question because, for example, we grow red seaweeds, let's say in Indonesia and the Philippines, and this seaweed will be used to extract carrageenan and agar, which are used as gelling agent, emulsifying agent. But so you sequester transiently carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus in your seaweed. You harvest them. You transform them in phycoalkaloids. But this carrageenan, this agar, in terms of chemistry, are repeat unit of two sugars. Okay, so and each sugar has 6 carbon. So carrageenan and agar, that's 12 carbon, 12 carbon, 12 carbon, 12 carbon, 12 carbon, polymers of 12 carbons. And it means that in your ketchup, you have a lot of carbon in your ketchup. So you harvest, harvested it from the sea, you process it, it become another product, it has not disappeared, it has not been permanently sequestered, it has been transformed in something else. And, you know, there is a great sentence from the French chemist Lavoisier, more than 2 centuries ago, say, nothing is lost, nothing is created, everything is transformed. And integrated multitrophic aquaculture, circular economy is all based on transformation, but it doesn't disappear.
It's now a good time to start talking about slow carbon cycle and fast carbon cycle and maybe explain the difference.
Yes.
Between those two concepts for those that might not be familiar with it.
Well, The slow carbon, that's what we talk in our paper, the slow carbon cycle, it's when you take something and you recycle it. Yeah, we have a diagram in our paper. So the fast carbon cycle, it's something that you recycle, and that's maybe over 10 years, compared to, if you want, the slow carbon cycle, that will be something where the carbon is stored, not necessarily permanently, but is stored for more than 10 years. Because
that's, is that the cutoff then?
For us, yes. Fast carbon cycle is less than 10 years. Slow carbon cycle is more than 10 years. But even that, there is not much agreement at the present time on what is sequestration. Is that when you put carbon aside for 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. Not everybody agree on that. And for me also is the word sequestration. We have modified because originally, you know, for example, you sequester a jury, you have a court trial, you have a jury, you sequester the jury, but that's for a few days, maybe a month.
Hopefully not for 10 years.
But it's not to make them disappear permanently. So after a few days or a few weeks or months, they are released after they gave their verdict and everything. So sequestration originally has nothing to do with permanent. So this idea that carbon has to be sequestered permanently or nothing. No, that's why in the paper, we use the term transient sequestration. It can be sequestered for a while and then used for something else.
One of the other areas discussed, obviously linked to this in your paper, is pointing at some of the potentially false claims attributed to seaweed and carbon sequestration. From your perspective, what is the most frustrating claim that you've heard about seaweed and climate change?
Well, there is this idea, yes, seaweeds are the superheroes, they are the warriors that will save the planet. Another thing also that we see all the time in the media, in social media, the news, is this idea that seaweed can grow up to 6 feet a day. It's something that is around. I have tried, other people have tried to find the origin of this thing. That's not true. Yes, you have kelps, and especially on the Pacific coast, we have giant kelps. On the East Coast, we have kelps, but they are not as giant. But even giant kelp doesn't grow 6 feet a day. I mean, 6 feet a day is almost 2 meters a day. That's huge, but it's around. And then the problem is, what happened when you have, you know, this famous elevator speech. So you are in the elevator, you have a few seconds to convince an investor before you arrive to floor one or floor two. And of course, you go with, but you know, seaweed grow tremendously up to 6 feet a day. So of course, the investor will be, oh, geez, that's unbelievable. And then if you start to make calculation based on these wrong numbers, then you say, okay, there is so many tons and there is so much carbon in per ton, blah, blah, blah. So you arrive to wonderful numbers, but that's not the case.
Is this sort of misinformation or misinterpretation of the data part of what pushed you personally to publishing the paper in the first place?
Yeah. No, we were a few people. We are five people on this paper. And we know each other for a while, and we say it's about time we work together and put something together, because so much is going on, so much hype. And that's funny, because for me, you know, I have been, as I say, I have been working on seaweed for 42 years. And I would say for 40 years, I have been seaweeds, don't forget them. You will see one day seaweeds are important. And now the last 2 years, I have been, whoa, slow down. Seaweeds are great. Like I said at the beginning, seaweeds are great, but let's not promise the moon. Because what I have seen is, when you are old enough, there was a previous period of promising the moon. That was in the 70s, 80s, when the idea was, so 70s, that was the oil crisis, you know, Middle East oil crisis, and the price of oil went to the roof. So people said, do we have alternative to that? And then some people say, oh, yes, we will do biofuel from seaweeds, and everything will be solved. And I mean, 40 years later, we don't have one drop of commercial seaweed biofuel. Some people are still working on it, but there is nothing commercial.
And so, nothing commercial.
No. So we promise the moon, And then there is what I said, this period of promising the moon, there is what I call the purgatory period. So yeah, people working on seaweeds as academics or people wanted to develop companies and develop things, then, and I have been exposed to that, some people telling me, oh, seaweeds, oh, you work on seaweed. Why are you wasting your time working on seaweeds? It doesn't work, we cannot make money, blah, blah, blah. So then you get a period for 40 years where seaweeds are bad. And then suddenly, poof, we have another hype period where seaweeds are great. So I would like to avoid this period of hypes and then trough, you know, the purgatory period and then hype and trough. I would like to see something much more. That's what I say, you know, we have to be careful that seaweed don't have a moment, but that we increase the seaweed momentum. We want to build a momentum and increase the recognition. Yes, for a very long time, seaweed have not been recognized for what they can provide. So it's true. So that we say seaweeds are important in the ecosystem. Seaweed can provide very interesting ecosystem services. We can do a lot of things with seaweeds, many applications. That's great. But be careful, because after a period of hype, there is a period of purgatory. And what will happen for the next 30, 40 years for students or academics or entrepreneurs that want to do something on seaweed if we add false claims? So that's more what I am worried on, where I say slow down. Seaweed are great, but let's be careful.
It sounds like this is something that concerned you and your team, and that's obviously something that, as a reader of your paper, I think came through.
Yeah, okay, great.
From that, then, do you think is the argument for carbon sequestration using seaweed farming completely unfounded? And if so, do you think it still makes sense for seaweed farming to be part of carbon offsetting schemes and generate carbon credits similarly to tree planting projects?
Well, that's a little the same thing what happened with you know, the green economy on planting trees. And there have been a period of green washing, people will say, green economy, green washing. Mm-hmm. So I am afraid now we are transitioning to blue economy on the period of blue washing. So that's why I am saying, you know, instead of green economy, blue economy, I like, and that's the name of our company, we call it Turquoise Revolution. Because for me, if you make a blue economy greener, blue and green, that makes the color turquoise. So that's why we call it Turquoise Revolution. And that's what we have to think about. So yes, we should calculate a value for the ecosystem services provided by seaweeds. And again, we should go beyond carbon. Everybody get excited about carbon, carbon, carbon. But as a matter of fact, in another paper, we show that there is more money to be made with nitrogen trading credit on phosphorus trading credit. And as a matter of fact, a lot of climate change issue and also acidification of the oceans, people are always talking about carbon, but other nutrients, especially nitrogen and phosphorus, are very important.
That's really interesting. It doesn't sound like there is a system in place for that. I think you mentioned this concept in a interview for the Atlantic International Research Center last year.
Yeah.
And when you said something that really caught my attention, that you just said, now there is more money to be made with nutrient trading credits than there is with carbon trading credits. And that really...
Yeah, because everybody focus on carbon, because on land there is already discussion about carbon tax. But again, if you look at carbon tax, that's a calculation we made. So Canada has a carbon tax at the present time, and it's planned to be increasing gradually. But if I look at one of the cheapest type of seaweed you can buy on the market, and I look at the value of the carbon tax, I can make more money selling my seaweed for other application than selling my seaweed for tax, for carbon tax or carbon credit. I will have to multiply the carbon, the present carbon tax by more than 50 times, okay, to make it valuable for a seaweed farmer or seaweed harvester to sell his or her seaweed for tax compared than to other applications. So a minimum of 50 for the cheapest seaweeds. And then when you look at the evolution of the carbon tax in the next decades, I calculated also that it will take 108 years, to have the price of seaweed and the carbon tax match. Until then, you can make more money using seaweed for other applications, for a seaweed farmer to sell them for carbon tax. And then 108 years is a long time because people tell us we have to find a solution for the in the next 10 years. So 108 years, it's a little longer.
So nutrient trading credits would be a much better from to a certain extent, yep, and fairer way to give a financial incentive to seaweed farming and, you know, seaweed aquaculture.
I think there is a lot to be done with nitrogen and phosphorus, especially when people will understand that acidification and how to do deacidification has much to do with nitrogen and phosphorus.
And how far do you think we are from implementing a system that would take into account nutrient trading credits? Is it done anywhere?
No. You know, at the present time, there is still a lot of work to be done with carbon because there is not so many countries that have a carbon tax. Canada is one of the countries with a carbon tax, but even within Canada, there is a lot of discussion and not everybody agree and not everybody agree at the price it should be and all these things. So a lot of countries at the present time don't have carbon tax or credit.
Going back to carbon sequestration for a second. There's been a recent article on Bloomberg Green that talks about how only in the past month, Google, Elon Musk, and several groups of private investors have committed to a total of more than $2 billion mm-hmm. to startups that propose solutions to remove carbon from the atmosphere. When it comes to seaweed, particularly seaweed farming, can we farm seaweed for sinking carbon down to the bottom of the ocean? And perhaps the better question, should we farm seaweed for sinking carbon to the deep ocean?
Well, there is a feasibility of doing it. Is it easy to do? I'm not sure. I would much prefer, instead of promising that, that we study if it can be done. Because that's the part of the problem is promising the moon is also deflecting or misdirecting the funds. My seaweeds, do I want to sink them to the bottom of the ocean? Or we have a seaweed at the present time we are cultivated that has property that are anti-Parkinson properties. So do I want to help solve the problem of people with Parkinson's disease or neurodegenerative disease in general? Or do I sink my seaweed to the bottom? So there is some ethical problems there. And then also all these seaweeds, we are working, one of the problems at the present time, people get better and better at growing seaweed, but what do you do with this big pile of seaweeds on the wharf at the end of the day? And one of the big problem is drying seaweed or preserving seaweeds. So we are working at the present time on a seaweed dryer, but I get a few $1,000 here, a few $1,000 here. I don't get $2 million. But we need, at the present time, the bottlenecks are better way of drying or preserving seaweeds, better harvesting boats. We have been harvesting for several years now, so we know what work, what doesn't work, what should be improved. We would lack, and we have the idea of what will be an ideal seaweed harvesters. But again, I have a hard time to find the money for it. Also money to improve the hatchery, because seaweed don't hatch eggs, but it's just like with animal. Everybody talk about hatcheries, and it's the early stage. A lot of the early stage of cultivation of seaweed, before you get the big seaweed at sea, it starts in the lab. And we would like to, we have small hatcheries, but we will have to scale it up and change things to be more efficient. That's for me as a key issue, is drying, harvesting, early cultivation. I would like to improve that, and we need some money for that. But for me at the present time, the danger is misdirecting some fund because of flashy little talks, but not addressing the key issues, the key important issues of growing, harvesting, drying.
There's so much to do, and there is such an incredible range of different possibilities and applications from, I'm looking at the products, and it doesn't even stop there, but if we're looking at the products, you know, you can go from seaweed snacks to fertilizers, animal feed, biofuels, you mentioned earlier, just to name a few. So if we could make just one thing now using seaweed or around seaweed, what do you think we should be making, and why?
Well, it's a little like, you told me there is not... seaweed are not the 100% silver bullets. I will say the application, the use of seaweed, it's not 100%. At the present time, ourselves, we are developing a product for human consumption. We are also developing for animal consumption, like, for example, sea urchins. If you want to grow more sea urchins, well, if you want the right color, because that's very important for the Asian market, to have the right color, the right texture, there is no secret. You can put them on artificial diet, but after that, you have to, at the end, polish them with good old seaweed. So there is animal feeding, there is human feeding, there is nutraceutical, I told you, potential with anti-Parkinson, cosmetics, bioplastics. Some people also are talking about that.
So we should do them all.
Some seaweeds are better at other things. That's another frustrating thing. Seaweed will do everything. But the problem is we have around 12,000 species of seaweed in worldwide, okay? So it's a huge group. This group is in evolution, in genetics, people say seaweeds are not monophyletic. They don't come from one ancestor, but there is several ancestors. So they have different properties because they don't come all from the same ancestor, like a tree of life and all these things. So because of this different origin, they have different properties. They produce different compounds. So it means that seaweeds from certain groups will be good, for example, at proteins, but some will not have too much protein. Some will be good at absorbing nitrogen. Some will be good at producing a certain pigment, but the other will not. So that's the thing. Seaweed will do everything. No, some group of seaweeds are very good for some applications. And then it depends what you have. Some part of the world have more that type of seaweeds, more that. So where the entrepreneurs, the company are located, some seaweed company will develop that application because they have the seaweeds that will give them this product. And then, unfortunately, they are not good for another application, but they are very good for that. So I think that worldwide, that's why we will see company developing different products. There is also another thing at the present time, and I hope it will change again with circular economy, is what people call biorefinery. At the present time, just like in many industries, you take a compound, You take a seaweed, you produce a certain compound, and the rest is waste again. But instead of just saying, oh, I produce that compound, which is maybe 20-40% of the biomass, and then what do I do with the 60-80% remaining? As I say, my industry is focused so much in this product, then it's 60% waste, which I discard. Or then if you diversify, and that's also where the company have to work, can I say my original product is 40% is for that compound, but this 60 lets me stop discarding it. Is there interesting compound in this 60%? And then I will maybe reduce it to 40 to 30%. And then my waste, because there will always be a waste somewhere. You know, when people say zero waste, in a production, there is always a little waste somewhere. Now you want to reduce that percentage of waste, but there is always some. But that's what we have to work is biorefinery. Can we do one species, not only one process, but several processes for several products? And that's what we have to work on too.
Should we coin a new expression then? Maybe go for a integrated multi-product aquaculture. What do you think of that?
I call it working on IMTS, ISBR, Integrated Sequential Biorefinery.
Fantastic. Well, you've heard it here first. There's definitely an education element, isn't there? And
yes.
And hopefully, I'd like to think podcasts and, you know,
yes,
tools like this can maybe help. And
yes.
Because at the end of the day, the seaweed industry in the West is a relatively new thing. I mean, obviously, it's been going on for centuries in Asia. But
I would say in the West, it's new in terms of eating seaweeds, okay? Because Asians have been eating seaweed for centuries, so eating seaweed in the West is new. But using seaweed for commercial application, the West has 2-3 centuries of commercial use. Like it has been used for ashes and potash and on the soda and by burning the seaweed. And then came the understanding of phacocolloids, so the colloids that you use in your orange juice in the morning and the toothpaste at night, so that the paste, toothpaste is a paste, not a liquid coming out of your tube. So you use seaweeds almost all day long, but you don't know it.
We just didn't know it.
No. The toothpaste is a paste, not a liquid, because there are some extract either from red seaweed or brown seaweed. And the same in your orange juice in the morning, for avoiding that the pulp settle at the bottom of your bottle, or the cacao powder in chocolate milk settle at the bottom, you put some red seaweed extract in it. So the extraction of seaweed extract, you know, in the West has easily more than 200 years. What is new and what people are rediscovering the wheel in the West is, oh, we can eat seaweeds, and after all, they are not that bad. On our side, the Turquoise Revolution, we have a lot of picture in our galleries about different recipes and different things you can do, eat seaweeds. And they are wonderful ingredients and can replace some vegetables and all these things. So, and again,
and do you find that people are receptive to that kind of new product?
Yes, it's coming, but it will take time in the West, you know, because the reaction, the term seaweeds doesn't help, because seaweeds for most Westerners is a sticky, gluey thing, wash ashore, and I don't like them. Instead of saying, well, we can do, and they taste really good, and they can be wonderful in some recipes. Now we just, last week, we just launched a seaweed beer. that is done, that is brewed right where we are in St. John, New Brunswick, by a brewery, Garon House. Garon House work with us, and we gave them some seaweed, and they develop a beer. We have developed a bread mix. We are working on seaweed jam. And so, but it's taking time. And what you have to realize is in Asia, they eat seaweeds, not, you know, each time it's a few grams, but it's a few grams, I would say, breakfast, lunch, and supper, multiplied by many millions of people. Then that's a few tons at the end of the day. But in the West, no, I mean, the sushi bar, you know, when I go to a sushi restaurant, for me, it's not the rice on the fish or invertebrate inside. For me, what is important is the rolls around, you know, the generally purplish, dark purplish. So what I look is, for me, the good quality come from the roll outside, not so much of what is inside. But sushi bars have been great at popularizing seaweed food, that's for sure. But it will take time. How often do you go to a sushi bar, and how often do you say, oh, the seaweed were part of the menu, and they were really interesting for flavoring, texture, and all these things?
Yeah, there hasn't been many stories of people going to a sushi bar and coming back and saying, oh, the seaweed was excellent.
That's it. Yeah, they will say, oh, the sushi roll was great, but then it will be the roll was great, and for me will be, oh, the quality of the wrapper. Was the wrapper good or not?
Well, what do you think? I'm afraid it's probably going to come down to marketing potentially, but what do you think the seaweed industry is doing wrong at the moment, and what do you think is doing right?
The traditional seaweed industry is doing fine. We should reduce the hype, reduce oh, it's new, and it's wonderful, and it will solve the climate change. So maybe reduce a little the hype, stick to the science. And what it's doing well, it's, yes, there are new applications. There is a traditional food for human, food for animal, so animal feed, pharmaceutical, nutraceutical. Now what is emerging is this bioplastic that could be very interesting. So that there are new compounds, that there are new applications coming out of seaweed, that's great. So diversification of product, and again, in different parts of the world, it will be different type of diversification. Not everybody will do everything. That's great. So there are some wonderful property of seaweed, the wonderful application, and then also make people realize more the ecosystem services. You know, people talk about ecosystem services, but we have to go beyond to say, oh, seaweeds are good for that, seaweed are good for this. We have to put a value. What is the value of absorbing this nitrogen, phosphorus, this carbon, even if it is temporary? What is the value of seaweed forest?
As a habitat.
As an habitat, that's where I was going. Seaweed forest as an habitat, or also reducing erosions, for example. Because what people realize is, and there is an example, for example, in an airport in Japan. So Japanese are great at developing artificial island. I think it's the new airport of Osaka is an island on the sea. But they put a lot of concrete blocks and everything, but it was still moving because of all the impact of the wave, storms, and the island was still moving. Then a seaweed professor, Dr. Hono, say, you know, in your concrete blocks, you should start to make holes. And of course, the engineers say, wow, if you make holes in concrete, the stability, the resilience and everything of my concrete will be reduced. And he said, no. Make them with little space, irregular and everything. And that will favor the development of kelp beds. And so the engineer said, well, yes. But he said, you know, you have to realize natural kelp beds, what do they do? They look like a shock absorber. You know, you have the waves come like that, bang, bang. And then if you have seaweeds that are there just to absorb the shock of the waves, then there will be less erosion. So, yes.
Incredible.
So, in a paper last year, I was looking at ecosystem services of seaweeds. So I found 22. And then, since then, I found two more. So I am at 24, 24 ecosystem services. But the first, I think where we are is, we are starting to understand ecosystem services. For me, I want to go the next step, which is, can we put a value on these ecosystem services? And if we have a monetary value, then can we use seaweeds in changing regulations or new regulations, but or incentive? Okay, if you do that, you should get an incentive because you provide ecosystem services that are useful for nature and useful for humans. So at the present time, we are identifying, which is important step, we are identifying ecosystem services. The next step is, let's put a value, let's monetize these ecosystem services. And the next thing is, let's use them as incentive to develop regulation or change existing regulations. So, a lot of work.
Yeah, well, we need to do an episode of the podcast on the 24.
Yes, that could keep us busy. But,
yeah, busy,
but that's,
work of
that. Yes, but that's for me. I was, as a matter of fact, it was during the holidays, and I was on the beach there, and I was writing and I was putting my ideas together, and then yes, I came with a list of 22. So I was an enjoyable afternoon on the beach, but it was a very productive afternoon.
Yeah, 24, that's impressive.
Yeah.
Look, we talked a lot about the pain points and the frustrating things, but I want to sort of continue on what you just mentioned here, the future and what sort of change and innovation you would like to see in the industry that would make your life a lot easier, or that you just think is absolutely needed. Does it come down to regulation, do you think? Is it a change of in legislation that we need, or is it what do you think it is?
Yes. Well, at the present time in Canada, like the development of integrated multitrophic aquaculture, where we mix fish with seaweeds and invertebrates. So biologically, environmentally, everybody agrees it's a good thing. Where we are not progressing as fast as we could, it's because of two things, the economics and the regulations. The regulations at the present time in Canada, and I think it's the same in Norway and in Scotland, Ireland, the regulations are mostly based on salmon regulation, because it's dominating aquaculture activity at the present time. And it's very difficult from a regulatory perspective to say, associated with the fish, we also want to grow seaweeds, we also want to grow invertebrates, because the regulations are not there for that. So regulatory, that's slowing us down. And then the economics, because in the Western world, again, people not being as aware of seaweed as in Asia, people say, oh, what do I do with seaweed? Or what's the value of seaweed? And of course, that's new development. So the tonnage are small compared to tonnage of salmon. So, of course, at the beginning, you make more money with your salmon than with a few ton of seaweed, a few ton of invertebrates and all these things. So it takes time. But at the same time, what really is surprising is during we had the Canadian IMTA network, and over these 7 years, we produce 11 economic papers, because what was nice with this network, we had biologists, but also economists and social scientists working together. And the economists produced 11 papers and theses, and it shows that IMTA economically make more money than a monoculture of salmon. And then, but people are not switching. So at the present time, it's perceptions of economics and the lack of enabling regulation, revised regulations that don't help us.
I'm conscious that it's getting late and I don't want to take you too long. We're getting toward the end of this chat, and So I'm going to ask you a very self-serving question, if that's okay. What advice would you give to someone starting up a small business in the seaweed industry? Could be anything that comes to mind.
It's a great job. It's a great activity. You will not be a millionaire overnight. So be patient. It will happen. You will develop. You have a good product. You have a good story. But don't over inflate the story. Stick to the science, stick to realistic stories. No, I told you, for 42 years I work on seaweed, and I am convinced that seaweed is one of the very important crop to produce. But it will take time. It will take time to change perception in the Western world. So patience.
Patience and science.
Patience, perseverance, perspiration, transpiration. it's a bright future. So I don't want people to take me wrong. There is wonderful things to do with seaweed, but let's reduce the hype a little.
Thierry, it's been extremely interesting to talk to you today. We've covered a lot, which we were expecting. It feels like we could keep going for hours and hours. I think we should probably wrap this up for now. Where can people find you and your company online?
Yes, the company, we are the Turquoise Revolution. Another name is Chopin Coastal Health Solutions, and I am on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on the company where we grow the seaweed is called Magellan Aquafarm. So Magellan Aquafarm, Chopin Coastal Health Solution, and Turquoise Revolution. And also for people interested in my papers, on presentations, you can find them on ResearchGate. Okay, ResearchGate in one word. So it's ResearchGate Thierry Chopin or something like that. And you can see all my papers, some of my presentations.
Brilliant. And there is a lot of them.
And on Turquoise Revolution, there is also galleries of pictures at the site, harvesting and food. And then on media, we posted also a lot of videos and interviews. There is more than 40, 45 TV, radio interviews and everything. So there is a lot of information there.
Thanks so much again.
You are welcome. And thank you for the questions. Were really interesting. And yeah, we cover a lot, but it's just the surface.
Thank you, Thierry.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.